is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Listen to verse 255 of chapter Baqarah, recited by Mr. Ali Asghar Burumand.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Allahu la ilaha illa لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات وما في الأرض من لا تأخذه سنة ولا نوم له ما في السماوات والأرض من ذا الذي يشفع عنده يعلم ما بين أيديهم وما خلفهم ولا يحيطون بشيء من علمه إلا بما شاء ولا يؤوده حفظهما وهو العلي العظيم. صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Allah is He, besides whom there is no God, the ever-living, the self-subsisting, by whom all subsist. Slumber does not overtake him, nor sleep. Whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth is his. Who is he that can intercede with him but by his permission? He knows what is before them and what is behind them, and they cannot comprehend anything out of his knowledge except what he pleases. His knowledge extends over the heavens and the earth, and the preservation of them both tires him not, and he is the Most High, the Great.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news. Deadlines: Iran calls on the UN Security Council to hold certain states accountable for imposing unilateral sanctions as a method of war to starve innocent civilians. The US says China is challenging Europe's security and economy, asking the European states to help Washington counter competition from Beijing. And more shootings are reported in the US, including one in a church in the state of Iowa, amid calls for action on gun violence. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: Iran's ambassador to the United Nations has censured that is the Security Council for failing to fulfill its responsibility with regard to some serious violations of international law, in particular illegal sanctions on Iran. Majid Takht Ravanchi told the council that certain states are using coercive measures as a method of war to starve innocent civilians. He underlined that the US has targeted Iran with the most severe economic and financial sanctions, which directly endanger the lives of the vulnerable population. The Iranian ambassador said the sanctions have even caused deaths of some Iranian patients, including children, as a result of restrictions on medicine and medical supplies. He was addressing an open debate at the UN Security Council on strengthening accountability for and justice for serious violations of international law. Political commentator Jim Kavanaugh says the sanctions warfare is at the heart of the current U.S. foreign policy.
The foreign policy of the United States now is based on sanctions. It's based on coercion and threats. And we've seen this before. Look, it happened in Iraq. And Madeleine Albright is famous in the 90s for saying it was worth the price of 500,000 children, dead children, to sanction for the sanctions on the Saddam Hussein. You know, that went on for years and caused, she acknowledged, 500,000 dead children. So the United States now has a policy pursuing a foreign policy of sanctions, sanction warfare and siege warfare against countries that it wants to discipline. And, you know, like with Russia now and like with Iran, nothing Iran's going to do is going to stop these sanctions. The sanctions aren't going to stop until and unless Iran comes into compliance with the American and Israeli hegemony in the region, and Iran isn't about to do that. So, you know, that's really what it's about. And they're punishing them for not being compliant with American and Zionist program for the region. And Iran is a very powerful country and a strong and a big country, and they need to kind of cut it down if they can.
China has warned any confrontational moves at the upcoming meeting of the IAEA's Board of Governors will only undermine cooperation between Iran and the agency and disrupt the negotiation process on the revival of the 2015 deal. The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman made the comments after reports said the US, the UK, France and Germany have prepared a draft resolution to push the Board of Governors to rebuke Iran at the board's June the 6th meeting. Zhao Lijian said exerting pressure on Iran and the UN agency will escalate tensions and complicate the situation. He called on Washington to make a political decision as soon as possible on the revival of the agreement known as the JCPOA. The official urged the White House to actively respond to what he called Iran's legitimate concerns and work toward an early consensus on outstanding issues. Political commentator Alfred Desires says the United States, Britain and Israel manipulate UN agencies like the IAEA in an attempt to achieve their anti-Iran goals.
Well, double standards are not uncommon in the UN system, and UN reports are not always balanced. They are subject to being weaponized against certain countries and not against others. Now, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the NPT of 1970, as you know, there are 191 states bodies. Iran is the state body, not, however, Israel, India, Pakistan, North Korea. So it's not universal. In Article 10 of the NPT would allow Iran to denounce the treaty if it wants to, if it feels that its national security is at stake. Now, nobody wants that. United States intelligence services, United Kingdom, Israeli, who all work hand in hand, they have one goal, and that is to have regime change in Tehran. So anything that might destabilize, anything that might, shall we say, diminish the influence of Iran in world affairs is welcome. And for that purpose, you use whatever agencies, United Nations agencies and other agencies, and of course, the media.
People in the Iranian city of Karaj, along with military officials, have gathered to honor Shaban Nasiri, a senior Iranian military commander who was killed by Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Before Shaban Nasiri stepped on a Daesh explosive booty trap in Iraq 5 years ago, he had been barely known to the Iranian public as a pivotal military commander. But it's the fifth year in a row now that people in his hometown Karaj assembled on June the 2nd to pay tribute to the former commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, referring to him as a forerunner of the fight against terrorism and a flag bearer of security in the region.
During the Iraqi war on Iran in the 1980s, General Nasiri held key positions and offered valuable services to protecting Iran's soil. After the war, he did not sit on his laurels and rushed to the Iranian eastern borders to help fight drug smuggling. And finally, when he saw that the region was plunging into chaos triggered by Daesh terrorists, he went to Iraq and Syria to combat the terrorists, where he finally was martyred.
General Nasiri was a senior commander in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' overseas operation unit known as Quds Force. He was a key advisor to the then Quds Force commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq in 2020. Nasiri stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. He was killed at the age of 59 during the liberation of the Iraqi city of Mosul from Daesh.
Shaban Nasiri played a key role in recapturing Mosul from Daesh. I was witness to his efforts there. Late General Soleimani likened him to martyr Jahan Ara, who liberated Iran's city of Khorramshahr from Iraqi forces in the 1980s Iran-Iraq War.
General Nasiri was a founding member of the IRGC, and especially the Ba'ath Brigade, formed in 1982 with the aim of fighting Iraqi forces during the Iran-Iraq War. The Ba'ath Brigade once again rose to prominence in 2014 during the fight against Daesh terrorists, when Iran offered advisory military support to Iraq's army.
Here, they call Sha'ban Nasiri a living martyr. They say they continue to remember his name as an anti-terror military commander who lost his life to let the people of the region live in peace. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Karaj.
Yes, Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman says China is challenging Europe's security, economy and values. Sherman says China's actions matter for the future of Europe. She called on the continent to help the U.S. counter competition from Beijing. The U.S. diplomat also said her country remains vigilant over China's partnership with Russia. She added China will see consequences if it sends military equipment to Russia. Beijing in the past has denied such claims. It has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop smearing China's domestic and foreign policies. One such call came just last Friday when Beijing hit back at a speech by U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He had accused China of seeking to reshape the world order. More people falling victim to gun violence in the U.S., where calls are growing for tighter control on carrying arms. In the latest incident, a man shot dead two women in a parking lot of a church in Iowa State. He then turned the gun on himself. In Wisconsin, two people were injured after a man opened fire at a funeral. The shooter is now at large. The Thursday incidents are the latest in a series of shootings that have rocked the U.S. in the past weeks. President Joe Biden has now called on Congress to take action and impose tougher gun control measures.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21. Strengthen background checks, enact safe storage law and red flag laws, repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability, address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence. These are rational, common sense measures.
Biden's proposed measures have historically been blocked by Republicans in Congress. Gun safety advocates have pushed the president to take stronger measures on his own to curb gun violence, but the White House wants Congress to pass legislation. Just 2 weeks ago, an 18-year-old opened fire at an elementary school in Texas, killing 21, many of them children, 19 to be exact. An independent research group called the Gun Violence Archive has registered at least 230 shootings in the U.S. so far this year. The French government has effectively declared that the current economic woes of the people are going to last for years. Unprecedented inflation may not lift until 2024, and that could cause major problems for recently re-elected President Emmanuel Macron. Our correspondent Ramima Zahari has more from Paris.
France's government has warned, don't expect inflation to return to normal until the end of 2023. At nearly 6%, French inflation is the highest since 1985, and the government says the peak won't even be reached until this winter. It's a stunningly serious diagnosis. Inflation has seemingly been the number one voter complaint since the euro currency was introduced in 1999, and now it's worse than ever. Many are pointing the finger at the pan-European project, with Brussels demanding austerity and forcing Paris to ignore mass protests and public opinion.
This inflation is a symptom of the profound crisis caused by the policies of neoliberalism put in place since the 1980s. Above all, the policies seek merely to enrich stockholders and create constant dividends. This inflation is going to last, and the government is only making a wild guess that it will end by 2024.
Across the EU, only Malta has managed to keep inflation lower. France has been saved by its constantly derided socialist-inspired measures, such as caps on energy prices. However, many are demanding more price caps, re-indexed pensions, immediate bonuses, higher wages across the board, and especially for low-wage workers, in order to keep inflation from making the poverty rate skyrocket.
All the countries of the European Union are basically already in a recession. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by a forced era of austerity, which created a structural lack of demand and investment in Europe. Making massive public investments with efforts to an ecological transition would create both jobs and demand for goods and possibly avoid another Great Depression.
80% of France says they're watching their expenses more carefully, which seems likely to push France's consumer-driven economy officially into a recession next quarter. 70% are distrustful of their economic future, which is record pessimism so soon after a presidential election. After all the austerity, the French are being told to expect nearly 2 years of widespread economic hardship. That may not only affect this month's legislative elections, but it could lead to major social unrest yet again. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
Moving on, anti-war demonstrations have been held in Italy, with protesters calling on the government to stop sending weapons to Ukraine and leave NATO. The initiatives took place while the Italian authorities were celebrating the 76th anniversary of the Republic.
June the 2nd is the day Italy celebrates becoming a republic. On this day, in a referendum held in 1946, Italians opted to abolish the country's short-lived monarchy and adopt a republican form of government. Every year, the celebrations feature large military and official parades along the ancient Roman Forum in the presence of the highest officers of the state. Never before have controversies over the military parade been this contentious, with anti-war demonstrations held in a number of Italian cities, including Bologna, Padua, and Bari.
We are here to protest against the government's decision to send weapons to Ukraine and to stage a military parade on our Republic Day, while there is a war raging on in Europe.
One of the anti-war protests was held in central Rome, 500 meters away from the Republic Day celebrations. The initiative had been called by the base union USB and political party Power to the People.
Enough with military escalation in Ukraine, which is mainly in the interest of the US. Italy and the EU are not protecting people's interests. Most people don't want this war. We have to leave NATO, ASAP, and the Draghi government must go now.
Since the start of the Ukraine conflict, opinion polls have steadily shown over half of the Italians oppose sending weapons to Kyiv and believe sanctions against Russia are useless. Protesters are angered not only over the Mario Draghi government's military spending on Ukraine, which they say would be better spent on raising workers' wages. They are also opposing the government's decision to raise military expenditure from 1.4 to 2% of the country's GDP.
This is a criminal choice. It's unbelievable. After years of slashing the welfare state, shame on the government.
I don't have anything against arms spending if weapons are used for defense purposes, not to fight proxy wars or to pillage other countries.
According to studies carried out by a number of Italy-based think tanks, Italians have never been eager to increase defense expenditures. Based on data from the 1950s to date, on average, less than 20% of respondents believe that military spending is too low or should be increased. Max Civili, Rome.
And that report brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness. And I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change. And that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Fundamentals of Imam Khomeini's political thought. In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to the program. One of the fundamental principles of Imam Khomeini's thought was to concentrate main issues on the axis of the pure Muhammadan Islam, as the Imam used to call true Islam. The thought rules out secular Islam and backward Islam. He said, Islam is the religion which opens the way toward man's spiritual sublimity through material activities. He also said, genuine Islamic recognition will guide us to the advancement of a society full of human talents and piety and social justice. Imam Khomeini, instead of relying on hollow materialistic powers, seriously relied on God's infinite power, as he believed that God will not leave alone his helpers and the helpers of his religion. The Imam experienced the hardest events with the same thought and belief. He did everything as a religious duty. His jihad in the way of God, his effort for formation of the Islamic rule, and thwarting the plots of enemies were all done for God's satisfaction. This does not mean that he didn't pay attention to social and economic affairs of people. Rather, he took everything into consideration, but through putting Islamic laws into practice. Imam Khomeini deeply believed in people's power. He considered all walks of life like himself. And this was the reason why the entire nation loved and supported him. The idea of republicanism was based on this very thought, as the Imam strongly believed that the system belongs to the people. In view of this, he kept recommending officials that they are the servants of people rather than their bosses. Imam Khomeini considered support for the poor parallel with social justice and a struggle against injustice and corruption. In view of this, among his main ideals were to materialize social justice, minimize class gap, remove unjust discriminations, support the poor, and fight poverty. Imam Khomeini paid high attention to struggle against oppression and global arrogance. The thought had its roots in the Quran and Islamic narrations. He would stand against any tyrant and oppressor both in social and political fields. Accordingly, he staged uprising against the tyrannical regime of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi and overthrew it with God's favor and people's support. He also stood courageously against the U.S., calling it as the Great Satan. The Imam was the first one who said, "America cannot do a damn thing." This has turned into the slogan of anyone who struggles against the U.S. Imam Khomeini turned the issue of fighting the fabricated Zionist regime and supporting the Palestinian nation into the main issue of the Islamic world. Imam Khomeini was the main caller to and banner bearer of unity. He believed that unity should be observed among all Islamic denominations and ethnic groups. According to the Quranic principle, the Imam maintained that no one is superior to others except for God-weariness. Today, the enemies of Islam, enjoying media empire, is doing its best to sow seeds of differences in a bid to weaken the Islamic Ummah and make various Islamic denominations suspicious of each other. This is aimed at misleading minds and thoughts from the main enemy, the U.S., and the fabricated regime of Israel. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was a true believer in independence. It means negation of all kinds of dependence, particularly on enemies. However, independence does not mean negation of interaction and communication with others. What is important as a principle in Islam is to negate dominance of foreigners and enemies on Muslims. This is against dignity and freedom of Islamic communities. One of the clear manifestations of independence in Imam Khomeini's thought was his special attitude toward relations with the US. From the beginning of his struggle against the Pahlavi tyranny, the Imam made it clear that the United States is the main cause of the Shah treachery and crimes against the Iranian people and the world. Therefore, he adopted an independent and uncompromising stance against Washington. Permanent struggle against the arrogant in the world, especially the US, and support for the oppressed and downtrodden was the infrastructure of Imam Khomeini's political ideology. After the victory of the Islamic Revolution, the American leaders have conspired incessantly to restrain this revolution or isolate it to defeat it. This, however, has not escaped Imam Khomeini's sharp look, as the US has failed in all of its plots. Imam Khomeini called the US, the government and not the people of the US, as the criminal of history, source of corruption, great Satan, world devourer, spiteful enemy of the world oppressed, number one enemy of mankind, enemy of Islam and the international looter. Imam Khomeini called relation with the US as the relation of wolf and lamb. He said that the superpowers want to milk us and there is no benefit in relation with them.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Midstream.
The flag scheme once again caused exceptional unification of all the resistance factions in Palestine and even further across the region. From Hamas to Fatah, with their unanimous agreement that organizing the march will lead to an explosion in Al-Quds, holding Israel fully responsible for the repercussions and development of events on the ground. The March of Flags is organized by right-wing Zionist extremists from the National Religious Movement and the Alliance of Religious Zionism, where settlers celebrate, dancing and waving provocatively the Zionist flags, their own so-called Jerusalem Day, which commemorates Israel's occupation of the eastern part of the city and Old Al-Quds during the Six-Day War in 1967. The Israeli decision to hold a march of flags in the heart of the old Al-Quds city, which took place on Sunday, May 29, along with the resistance factions in Gaza announcing their readiness to respond if the march passes through the Bab al-Amud and the Islamic Quarter towards the Al-Buraq Wall. In addition to the popular mobilization in the Palestinian interior, all bring back to the fore the battle of sovereignty over Al-Quds. Despite all of Israel's efforts, the occupation has yet to succeed in resolving this issue, amid fears within the Israeli establishment of losing what it refers to as sovereignty in unified Jerusalem. The path of the March of Flags is fraught with tensions, even within Zionist society, escalating the situation, as opponents of the path see the march through the Mughrabi Gate, Al-Wad Street, and the Islamic Quarter in Old Al-Quds as a provocation, while supporters see it as an expression of what they describe as Israel's sovereignty over Al-Quds, which represents the battle for sovereignty that has been going on for 55 years, ever since the Israeli colonial forces occupied the eastern side of Al-Quds. Israel aims to adhere to the March of Flags and its path to appear as if it possesses sovereignty and controls matters in East Al-Quds, as well as not to allow the consolidation and stabilization of the equation imposed by the Palestinian resistance movement in the uprising of Dignity last May, linking Gaza and Al-Quds, Palestinian interior and the West Bank through a comprehensive confrontation and broad popular movement that includes all Palestinians. The March of Flags has once again unified all the resistance factions in the Palestinian arena in an exceptional way, from Hamas to the Palestinian National Liberation Organization and Fatah, along with warnings issued by Hezbollah Secretary General Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah that any Israeli prejudice to Al-Aqsa Mosque would cause an explosion in the region. Israeli officials feared a repetition of the scenario of the events of Saif al-Quds, especially since the Palestinian factions did not rule out responding with rockets from Gaza in case the settlers escalate in al-Quds. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. The March of Flags, which settlers celebrate in the occupied city of Al-Quds, has not been of great importance for decades, but its importance has begun to appear in recent years with the increasing Zionist interest in the occupied city of Al-Quds and the desire to impose its full sovereignty over the city, including the holy area of Al-Aqsa Mosque. The new developments involved changing the route of the march, which used to stop at Al-Buraq Wall, but in recent years it has evolved into settlers entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque with their flags provoking every native Palestinian, putting all resistance factions on high alert. To discuss this issue with us from occupied Al-Quds is Mr. Samer Khalil, political commentator. Thank you for being with us. Mr. Samer, it's such an honor to have you with us from Al-Quds al-Sharif. Now, on Sunday, May 29th, we all saw live on television sets herds of settlers in the Israeli Zionist occupation commemorating the March of Flags by entering from the old city of Al-Quds towards Damascus Gate with their dancing and provocative slogans and attacks and aggression against native Palestinians. What are the implications of the March of the Flags this year, in specific in light of the security confusion that the occupation is living through in the occupied territories and its insistence on the Judaization of Al-Quds?
Good evening to you. I am truly delighted to be with you from occupied Al-Quds. The implications of the March of Flags is one. The Zionist government, day and night, is proving that it's an occupation government. We have never seen an entity across the globe that celebrates the day it occupied an entire nation. The Zionist government seeks and wants to present itself as an occupation government that has been occupying a whole nation for 74 years. What we saw on May 29, from the intensive presence of occupation forces, is simply an assertion that Israel is an occupation and that their ideology is one of occupation against a people that seeks freedom. The Zionist government took a decision to follow the Zionist extremists of its entity. The right-wing extremists obliged Bennett's government to follow through with the March of Flags, which exposed this government as one that is living in fear of its internal political strife. We all know that the governmental coalition and Bennett's government is on the verge of collapse. This urged Bennett to allow this march to take place with a new route it took, just to position himself as more far-right than the far-right extremists themselves. What the Globe witnessed on May 29 was shameful and truly unpleasant. But what made our day was the Palestinian flag that remained held high, despite the intense security situation and the random arrests and oppression in occupied Al-Quds. This flag remained held high as a witness for the occupation's oppressive ways in attempt to silence the Palestinian people. 74 years of occupation and the Zionist entity was still unable to Judaize Al-Quds or to influence the academic curriculums or to steal and change the cultural heritage of Al-Quds. Every day, the Palestinian citizen, and especially the residents of Al-Quds, prove that they are the righteous people of this land and that they are keen on preserving their Palestinian identity throughout history. We will remain the first line of defense for our Christian and Muslim sanctities in spite of the occupation.
Well, there's no doubt there, but the high-level precautions that were taken by the Zionist occupation, Mr. Samer, and their also their allies in the region were very precautious about this march of flags to protect this aggressive young group of extremists known as the Hilltop Youth. What is the reason behind these belligerent precautions? What is Israel really afraid of?
Simply because they know that they are not the righteous people. They are not the owners of this land. They are not the people of true cause. If they are truly owners of this land, they wouldn't have gathered all this security personnel and police force to protect a handful of Zionist settlers. If they were righteous people, they would have walked the path of the old city of Al-Quds without the need for protection. As we know, Israel cannot handle more than one military front line. Israel faces security threats on its southern front line and on its northern front line. Also, the situation in the occupied West Bank and internal occupied territories are set on a boiling plate. The Zionist entity perfectly knew that the situation can explode at any time, which means a complete collapse of the security and political system inside the occupation entity's government. This prompted them to increase the presence of their occupation forces on the southern and northern fronts, even in the West Bank and the occupied Al-Quds. Israel did all that to protect a handful of Zionist extremists known as the Hilltop Youth. This reflects that the Zionist government and this occupation is founded on the blood and skulls of the Palestinian people, a regime that has historically been built on an iron security fist. What is more important is that the Palestinian people were still able to preserve their identity, despite the horrific scenes and vast oppression that they experienced during the March of Flags. Palestinians still were able to remain steadfast despite the occupation's iron fist.
And added to that, Mr. Samer, all Palestinian resistance factions raised their alert level inside the Gaza Strip, as you just mentioned now, in anticipation of a possible military confrontation erupting not only then, also probably in the coming days, in parallel with sending messages through a lot of mediators to the Zionist entity. But where is the Arab and Islamic involvement, Mr. Samer, and their dignity throughout all this oppression and aggression that we saw on Sunday?
Being a nation under occupation for 74 years so far, it's only normal to remain on high alert. As for the Arab regimes, in light of the suffering their citizens live through, we still see that these regimes race and compete to normalize with the Zionist entity. We saw how there are certain Arab nations, well known for their normalizing ties with Israel, who try to mediate with Gaza not to respond for the Zionist provocations in Al-Quds. However, as long as the Palestinian people is under occupation, then they will remain the frontline defenders for their nation and their land. The Palestinian people have been suffering since the Nakba in 1948 and is still suffering from the same disappointing stances of these Arab regimes. All these regimes seek is to achieve regional calm, while completely forgetting an entire nation living and suffering under occupation. We only have hope in our Arab brothers and sisters, not in the regimes. The official Arab regimes have their own political priorities that are completely different than that of their citizens. Here lies the tragedy. The Palestinian people does not promise anyone with victories, but rather we promise our brothers that we will remain steadfast. The Palestinian people is ready to absorb all this oppression another 74 years. But until when will the Palestinian people be capable to remain steadfast in light of the waves of normalization hitting the Arab world? I believe that Israel is the biggest winner in all of this. Israel, which claims to be seeking peace, has tricked all these Arab regimes to make sure that it remains the true ruling leader in our region.
As you just said, Mr. Samer Khalil, that our trust is in the nations and not the regimes. I want to thank you very much, Samer Khalil, political commentator, for joining us from occupied Al-Quds al-Sharif. Thank you for your time. And please stay tuned, because next we will be talking about Iraq's new draft law that criminalizes normalizing with Israel.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marwa Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
In Iraq, the draft law criminalizing normalization with Israel, which was presented by the Sadrist movement's deputies and was approved in the first reading, raised questions about whether it aims in one way or another to circumvent the initiative of the coordinating framework for a political solution, which includes a clause criminalizing normalization. Regardless, Muqtada Sadr knows that it is difficult for him to impose such a law on his two partners in the tripartite alliance, Masoud Barzani, who was engaged in a process of normalization with the enemy dating back to the days of his father, and Mustafa Barzani, and Muhammad al-Halbousi, who is allied with normalized countries led by the UAE, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. Iraq criminalizes normalization in this following report.
Iraq's parliament has voted to criminalize any form of normalization with the Zionist entity Israel, threatening the worst offenders with life imprisonment or the death penalty. The law has been condemned by apartheid Israel and the U.S., of course, while most Iraqi politicians in Baghdad have welcomed it. Meanwhile, amid cautious silence so far in Erbil, Iraqi political circles are claiming that passing a bill to criminalize normalization with Israel in the Iraqi parliament is not without internal political calculations. Many Iraqi observers are pointing out that this step is an attempt by the leader of the Sadrist movement, Muqtada Sadr, to achieve self-marketing after he failed to achieve any of the stakes placed on him as the winner in the legislative elections, whether with regard to resolving the internal crisis that the country has been witnessing for nearly 8 months, or in passing bills that ease the impact of the economic crisis on Iraqi citizens, as in the case with the Emergency Food Security Bill. The Sadrist movement pushed this bill about a month ago, after accusations leveled against it for turning a blind eye towards the suspicious relationship between its allies in the Save a Homeland Coalition, the Kurdistan Democratic Party, and the Sunni Sovereignty Alliance, along with Israel. Iran has repeatedly accused the leaders of the Kurdistan region in northern Iraq of dealing with Israel to harm the Islamic Republic, and this coincided with the hints of some tribal figures who recently returned to the Iraqi scene that the sovereignty coalition, especially its leader Muhammad al-Halbousi, is implementing an Israeli agenda in the heart of Sunni geography in Iraq. Some Iraqi observers believe that the aim of the draft law presented by the Sadr movement in the House of Representatives was not to prevent the enemy's penetration into the Iraqi arena as much as it aimed to facilitate the formation of a majority government with the participation of the sovereignty coalition led by Muhammad al-Halbousi and Masoud Barzani's party. It is more likely, as suggested by the statements of those opposed to Assad, that the draft bill, which needs to be approved in two further readings before it becomes effective, aims to get ahead of the efforts of the Coordinating Framework Bloc, whose political initiative included a call for the adoption of a law criminalizing normalization with the enemy. The irony is that after Tehran targeted a Mossad headquarters in Erbil weeks ago with a number of missiles from where attacks against it were launched, Muqtada Sadr sought to deny the relationship of the dominant forces in Iraqi Kurdistan with the enemy and to condemn the Iranian bombing. Therefore, the probabilities today indicate that including this issue in the political bazaar aims to fill a large gap in the tripartite alliance that al-Sadr relies on to monopolize Shia representation within the Iraqi authority and thus rule Iraq as a whole.
Now, to discuss this issue with us from Baghdad is Sheikh Dr. Yusuf Al-Nasri, who is the Iraq's General Coordinator of the Global Gathering in support of the choice of resistance. I want to thank you very much, Dr. Nasri, for being with us from Baghdad. Now, last week, the Iraqi parliament voted unanimously on a proposal to criminalize normalization with the Israeli occupation. It is not a law yet, but what does it mean for Iraq?
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful, thank you for tackling this important topic for Iraq and the region. This draft bill that the Iraqi parliament voted for to criminalize normalization with Israel is simply a reaction to the so-called deal of the century. We witnessed several Arab states collapsing one after the other, competing to take part in this deal. The fast pace to broker this deal is the increasing strength of the resistance that encircles the Zionist occupation. Add to that our people's awareness alongside the strength of the resistance from Yemen passing through Persian Gulf nations to Iraq and Syria and Lebanon, and Iran, the nurturing and supportive power for the resistance. This huge axis, which is now also growing in North Africa, poses a real and strategic threat to the Zionist entity. Now we all know that Iraq is witnessing an exchange and alteration in politics and power between different blocs. We have a government formation that is being agreed upon in Iraq, and here is where an initiative was born to mend the rupture in Iraqi politics. The draft bill was a first step for the resistance axis in Iraq to criminalize normalization with Israel. Yes, we have several remarks concerning some points in this draft, but the first successful step is to make it illegal to make ties with the Zionist entity. This pushed all the agents of Zionist Israel and the U.S. into a real dilemma. From here, we can say that this draft bill was a bold and successful move.
Everything that you just mentioned, Dr. Nasri, is very important for Iraq, but many Iraqi media reported that the draft law presented by the Sadrist movement in the House of Representatives to criminalize the normalization with Israel was not aimed at preventing the enemy's penetration into the Iraqi arena as much as it aimed at facilitating the formation of a cabinet in a majority government in Iraq with the participation of the so-called Sovereignty Coalition led by Mohammed al-Halbousi and Masoud Barzani's party. How do you assess such a claim?
I believe that lately a serious conflict arises between the Sadrist movement, coalition, and Parliament Speaker Halbousi. Add to that in Iraq, there is a powerful axis carefully observing all the alterations at the political level. And this places the Sadrist movement at an embarrassing spot. This pushed the Sadrist movement, led by Sayyid Muqtada al-Sadr, to take this step to prove whether or not his allies, Halbousi and Barzani, can handle huge strategic projects in Iraq. From here, Muqtada al-Sadr tested his allies with this draft bill, especially after the Islamic Republic bombed Mossad positions in Erbil, after they had used Kurdistan to attack Iran. This places Sayyid Sadr in a very embarrassing position, pushing him to in turn embarrass his own allies after it was confirmed that Kurdistan housed Mossad agents. Either they prove they are patriots and choose to stand firm with him or not. This is why this draft bill was at the top list of the Iraqi parliament session under the supervision and support of the Sadrist movement. After this session, we saw that Barzani ditched the Sadrist movement and their coalition now is at the verge of collapse. However, Sayyid Sadr exposed them by pushing this bill forward. With this draft bill, Sayyid Sadr wanted to assure his firm stance against the Zionist entity and expose his allies who were openly accused of normalization. This was an appreciated and successful step for the Sadrist movement, despite the fact that we do have certain remarks concerning some of the bill points. So we hope for the correction of some of the law's details.
But this is an indication that a conflict might arise in Iraq, Dr. Nasiri, because Erbil was the center of normalization conferences with the Zionist entity in which one Sheikh Wissam al-Hardan participated in the last conference by orders of al-Halbusi himself. And even al-Halbusi himself wrote the final statement of the conference that was held in Erbil. This is what al-Hardan stated. So is this that draft law criminalizing normalization only maybe a trick with which it is intended to mislead public opinion?
When this draft bill becomes a law, it will definitely lead to strategic conflicts inside Iraq, simply because it exposed the real intentions of some politicians in Iraq, like the Kurdish Democratic Party, headed by Masoud Barzani. No doubt that Masoud Barzani has close ties with Israel. It's not a secret because he never hides it, just like his father before him. Kurds even send Peshmerga to get military training inside Israel. This is not hidden, on the contrary, they show these ties off. In proof of that, look at the mobile protests Kurds held in Erbil, where the disgraceful pro-normalization conference took place. The Kurds protested holding Israeli flags in the heart of Erbil, calling for open relations with Israel. However, this clear decision to criminalize normalization with the Zionist entity was a much-needed and bold move. The will and awareness of people, along with patriotic movements and blocs, is to stay away from every project that has to do with the Zionist entity. Sure, Halbusi and Barzani have been influenced by Western powers because they were brought in by the pro-Zionist Americans. However, they were exposed and they are now on the way to be held accountable by law. Our problem in Iraq is the conflict between patriotic movements who both support the resistance. It's about time that these patriotic movements join forces and stand together for the sake of Iraq, instead of building alliances with weak coalitions. Resistance blocs should build alliances amongst themselves, which is why we believe that this law came along to clean Iraq out of any Zionist agents and traitors.
Well, it seems that we will be looking at grave changes in Iraq, hopefully peaceful ones. I want to thank you very much, Sheikh Dr. Yusuf Al-Nasiri, the Iraqi General Coordinator of the Global Gathering in Support of the Choice of Resistance, Secretary General of the Shura Ulama in Iraq, and the President of the National Council of Trustees of Religions in Iraq. I want to thank you very much for your contribution from Baghdad, and thank you. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
In the limelight.
It's been 3 weeks since public health authorities confirmed the case of monkeypox in the UK. Please stay with us for an article in this regard, written by the staff of Nature magazine. This article is published under the heading Monkeypox Outbreaks: Four Key Questions Researchers Have. Here's more. It's been 3 weeks since public health authorities confirmed the case of monkeypox in the United Kingdom. Since then, more than 400 confirmed or suspected cases have emerged in at least 20 non-African nations, including Canada, Portugal, Spain, and the UK, the largest outbreak ever outside of Africa. The situation has scientists on alert because the monkeypox virus has emerged in separate populations across multiple countries, and there is no obvious link between many of the clusters, raising the possibility of undetected local transmission of the virus. We need to act quickly and decisively, but there is still a lot to be learned, says Anne Ryman, an epidemiologist at the University of California, Los Angeles, who has studied monkeypox in the Democratic Republic of Congo for more than a decade. Nature outlines some of the key questions about the recent outbreaks that researchers are racing to answer. Since the latest outbreaks began, researchers have sequenced viral genomes collected from people with monkeypox in countries including Belgium, France, Germany, Portugal, and the US. The most important insight they have gained so far is that each of the sequences closely resembles that of a monkeypox strain found in West